Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 94 of Weed All About It, the second part of what I'm calling Dennis Solbrack May Not Bleed Green, But He Lives Green, John Deere Green, about my conversation with the new product engineer at the Pappy Machinery location outside Colfax, Washington. I could have easily let both parts of my interview with Solbrack run for 45 minutes, but listeners tell me they prefer a length in the 20 to 25 minute time frame, and podcast statistics back them up. But it was particularly wrenching in episode 93 to delete Solbrack's discussion about grain drills, especially the HZ drill, which farmers in the drier areas of the state have been using to seed their summer fallow fields since the 1960s. Arg! In the podcast ahead, Solbrack and I talk about the biggest mistake farmers make with their equipment, what farmers can actually work on now that many machinery functions are controlled by computers, the consolidation of the equipment industry, and Solbrack's tongue-in-cheek comment that driverless combines aren't the future, they're already here, among many other topics. But rather than have me talk about it, let's go back to my conversation with Solbrack, which took place in his second-floor office, the walls of which are festooned with memorabilia from a long career. We began by discussing big data, the term that refers to the second-by-second information that modern tractors and combines transmit while planting and harvesting a crop. I asked Solbrack, who owns that information?
Right. Well, the farmer owns that data, and Deere has built the devices and the programs so that they can share that data or they can use that data for even a competitive piece of equipment. Say they have a different rate controller that they want to use their harvest data on. John Deere has what used to be called open architecture that allowed that to happen. But there's a lot in the news, you know, some good news articles and some not so good news articles about recently there's been some court cases with, and I know John Deere was involved in it, where the right to repair, I think, is one of the words that I've heard phrased about the machinery. And the difficulty for the manufacturer is the manufacturer is trying to provide a product that is serviceable over the long run. And let's just use the case of a tractor where you have a tractor that has the same cubic inch displacement engine, and it has three different power levels out of that cubic inch displacement engine. Now, to the farmer, he looks at it and says, well, it's got such and such cubic inches. I can buy the small one, and then I can chip it or put a different program on it, and I'll have the same horsepower as the larger one. Well, they don't see all of what's in a product. I mean, they can see the decal, obviously, and they can see the engine displacement. But does it have the same radiator size? And does it have the same turbocharger? Does it have the same air-to-after cooler? So the manufacturers have been trying to some degree, limit the repair, and I don't really think it should be called repair, but they've been trying to limit some of the access to these microprocessors, and it's not necessarily to repair them, but to modify them to make the product do something different than what it was intended. And, of course, there's legal things in there and possible lawsuits, because if some guy does this to his tractor and then it blows up and it's still in the warranty period, then everybody's pointing the finger at everybody, and it's kind of gotten to be a difficult issue. It used to be you had to change a part to change the performance of the machine. And now with a proper computer program, you can flick some switches or rewrite the program or trick the program and make it do something that the machine was not intended to do. I don't really think it's so much the right to repair, it's the right to modify. And of course, you know, there's lots of arguments both ways. You know, you can buy a Chevy pickup or a Dodge pickup, and there's people in the aftermarket that will sell you a chip that tells you that you can pull your house trailer up over the hill at 5 miles an hour faster. And, you know, maybe you can do that, but that's kind of an intermittent duty thing. You know, you got one hill to pull, whereas a tractor is out there pulling 100% of the time. And if the duty cycle on the tractor has been modified significantly, who's to know whether or not it's going to hold up or not? I mean, and how do you control that? It's a very difficult subject.
Yes, yes, indeed. All of my life in agriculture, the farmers have told me that what they do during the winter is they work on their equipment.
Right, yeah.
And my question is, what can they do on their equipment now in the winter?
Well, pretty much everything they used to do. We don't overhaul electrical systems. We don't overhaul hydraulic systems. I mean, obviously we fix leaks if there's a leak, but we don't overhaul them. The wear parts on a combine, whether it be in the feeder house chain, all of the wear parts on the combine are still a mechanical thing, and the farmers can repair mechanical things and help repair mechanical things, whether it be in their shop or a dealer shop. I mean, that hasn't changed, and I don't see that it's going to. The electrical stuff, it either works or it doesn't. And, you know, most customers, they'll fix an easy electrical thing that's visible to the eye, or a sensor goes out, they'll plug a new sensor in. But if it's a sophisticated electrical problem, they need to get the resources of the dealership. And we go out to the field with a laptop. I mean, that's a change in agriculture that we never, it kind of snuck up on us, right?
I mean,
we used to first use a laptop just as a storage of information, but now we hook to the machine and read the machine through the laptop. So that's a new day, right?
But you can
new day.
But you can also read the machine here at your
yes.
John Deere headquarters, right?
Well, yes. The newer machines we can, and the machines that have that system on them, yes, we can, which is... It also helps us find customers in the field because we can see a map and we can see where this guy is and we can send him to the right field because we can see where the machine is setting. So it's pretty, I mean, it sounds kind of far-fetched. Sounds like Dick Tracy's little phone that he had on his wrist, but it's reality today.
So when I started in agriculture back in 1986, I'd say that, John Deere machinery predominated across the landscape. And now as I'm out there looking around, there's a lot of Case IH equipment, a lot of red equipment out there. What has happened in terms of Case IH and, you know, really nipping at the heels of Deere?
Well, they're a viable competitor. They're a combination of Case and IH, and there's a number of manufacturers that have consolidated. Deere is the only manufacturer that hasn't consolidated in a large way with another major manufacturers, but the number of manufacturers have decreased steadily to here in the Palouse, it's primarily two manufacturers. So obviously, when there were seven or eight different manufacturers in the marketplace, and there were seven or eight different hillside combines at one time in the marketplace, and one by one they dropped out, and you know now there's two that offer a leveling system.
What about the track tractors? I mean, it seems like the Case IH was ahead of Deere in terms of having these tracks on tractors versus tires.
Well, there was a decision made by a group of farmers, one of which was from Colfax, Washington, and they went to a John Deere meeting, and at the John Deere meeting, they drove a four-track machine and a two-track machine and a wheel tractor and were trying to help Deere determine the direction for the future, and that conclusion from those 10 owner-operators was that they should pursue a two-track machine. And Deere has been in the two-track track business for quite a while now. Caterpillar was the one that introduced it to the marketplace. And obviously we have a number of customers that bought those tractors, and we would have preferred they bought a John Deere, but they were buying a product that did something a little different than a wheel tractor at the time. And then Deere had the two-track machines, and now, you know, Case IH had the four-track machine first, and now Deere has a four-track machine. So sometimes in the marketplace, things happen timing-wise that don't really make sense to the average guy, but there's usually reasons why someone determined what they were going to do or how, where they were going to spend their money to develop a new product. And sometimes we don't know those reasons, and sometimes we do.
And what's the advantage of the tracks versus the tires?
Well, they have better traction, and you know, you can argue about the ride. It depends on what kind of a field you're in. Basically, on a side hill, the tracks have an advantage over tires, especially on the steep, soft slopes. So it's dependent upon where you're at in the Palouse. I mean, there are some areas of the Palouse that's firm soil and it's not very steep. Obviously, a wheel tractor will go do the job. And the tracks have a price disadvantage. They cost more money to manufacture all those pieces. But, you know, the four-track machine is kind of the popular machine at the time now, and you know, farmers are utilizing that. I think some of them should be utilizing some wheel tractor power. The wheel tractor power is going to provide the power for less dollars per hour than a track vehicle, but you know, those things kind of settle out over a period of time too.
Okay, speaking of equipment, when are we going to see the first driverless tractor or driverless combine?
Well, we already have some. If you put a millennial in a tractor with a cell phone and you put it on auto steer, it's driverless until it gets to the other end of the field because he's busy playing on his phone, not watching what he's doing. But I don't know. My guess is 3 to 5 years, but it's kind of happening at the same rate that the auto steer cars and trucks are happening on the highway. Now, obviously, there's additional concerns about being out on the highway if you cross the center line, obviously, or run over a pedestrian like one of the Uber cars did. I think the first advent of the driverless tractors will be in a spray application, probably in an orchard or a vineyard where they don't want an operator exposed to the chemicals and they have good straight lines and good guidance. You know, they've already got the ability to make the corner at the end. So somebody has to program the machine to do the functions at the end of the row, that being shut off the sprayer or lift your implement or whatever it is that you need to do. So whether or not it's going to go completely operator-free, initially, I don't think that's going to happen in a great scale. I think it's probably going to go more towards there'll be a primary operator in the field and there'll be one or two additional tractors in the field that he is watching and monitoring, and they will be driverless and he will be making sure that they stay doing what they are intended to do. I think that's the first step. But most of those types of first steps will happen in the Midwest, and then we'll get it eventually, but it'll be a little farther down the road.
And that's an interesting question. Bank out wagons, they started in the Midwest and then they came to the Northwest. What is that time lag between Midwest to Northwest, do you think?
Oh, 5 to 10 years, generally. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of a blanket statement. Some things happen faster than that, some slower than that. Speaking of bank out wagons, the technology is available and has been for like 5 years where you can link the combine presence of where it's at and link that to the tractor that's pulling the bank out wagon, and the combine operator, once they sync up, can speed up or slow down the tractor so that he can fill the grain cart to the spot where he can visually see in the grain cart, and the grain cart and tractor will stay the correct width away from the combine, and the guy in the grain cart has got his hands off the steering wheel and his hands off the throttle. It's all done from the operator station. And I'm sure there's a number of operations using that in the Midwest, harvesting corn. I don't know of anybody here that's using it, but it's a technology that's available today. Just maybe hasn't quite caught on yet. But
so it's almost like a robot at this point, right?
Yeah, it is. It's a secondary machine linked to the primary machine, and the primary machine and operator has the control over it. So it's pretty cool stuff. And, you know, you just have to weigh the value of whether or not you think that that has value for your operation. And, of course, in addition to that, we've got the hills to contend with, so we can't unload on the go everywhere. So there has to be some common sense put into the equation.
And that brings up the question of hillside combines. It seems to me that you have to sell a certain number of hillside units to make it pay. With combines so big and fewer being sold, what will become of the hillside attachments?
Boy, that's a good question. I don't know if your next question is, you know, how many units are the minimum. I don't know that either. It's an economic question. We're down to the point where I wouldn't want to see sales of hillside combines much lower than what we're at and still have a viable manufacturer to build that attachment for us. But you never know. I mean, who's to say that the machine of the future won't need a leveler? I mean, I'm not saying it will or won't. I don't know exactly what they're working on, how they're going to separate grain from material other than grain, the straw and the chaff, what the needs of the future are. We have a new cellulose plant in Starbuck that is buying straw. And what I heard was they don't want any weed seed and they don't want any chaff. They just want pure straw to be most viable for their operation. So maybe the combine of the future will separate all those things out in a better way than we're currently doing it. I mean, we're currently doing it in such a way that obviously we put the grain in the bulk tank because that's what we sell and take to market. But the rest of it, we're trying to manage that for the next farm operation. We're not managing that to sell that product somewhere. We're managing that for the next farm operation, which is a tillage pass. So we want it spread out nicely. We want the chaff spread out across the full width. And so the combine is part of the first tillage operation, as it should be, right? I get that. But maybe the combine of the future will have bales coming out of it and chaff coming out of it in sacks and then grain, obviously, to the bulk tank. I mean, I don't know where that's going.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The sky's the limit, right?
Yes, yes.
We can build anything they want.
One last question, and that is, do you bleed green?
No, I bleed red, but I wipe it off real quick so nobody can see it. Oh, you know, John Deere's been good to me. I work for John Deere Company as a service rep, covered Southern Idaho, Northern Nevada, later covered Northern California and Western Nevada, and then later I was stationed in Walla Walla, and I've done a number of different jobs as a service rep, and then was a service rep for our own leveling business. So, you know, I've seen a lot of aspects of the business, and I enjoy the business. I enjoy seeing new products. I mean, going to a new product show used to be like Christmas time, you know, get to see something new. And we're always excited about you know, some new thing on the machine that in, that we figured out how to make one of our machines better. I remember being at a new product show and seeing that John Deere added a wheel angle sensor to the rear axle of a combine, and my son Jeff and I had in our minds figured out how to make what we call smart level, which we ended up patenting, but that enabled us to use that signal to put it into the equation so that we made a hillside combine stay level as it turned a corner, whereas centrifugal force used to apply itself against the leveling automatic leveling device and make the machine kind of turn in or lean over into the corner, kind of like you think of a race car at mm-hmm. at the Daytona 500. Well, we figured out a way to get around that, and that was kind of, you know, it's a fun thing to learn and dream about making something better and try to improve the world.
I lied. One last question. Is there a typical mistake that farmers make with their equipment?
A typical mistake? Well, there's lots of mistakes they make with their equipment, but we're careful how we say that to them. I don't know that there's just one typical mistake. I think that as the machines have gotten more sophisticated, the need for clean fuel, clean DEF. Now we have a DEF tank on machines.
And that refers to the emissions.
That's the emissions, the diesel exhaust fluid, clean oil, you know, clean the tips off your hydraulic hoses before you stick them in the back of your tractor. I mean, all the valves and, you know, all the intricate parts of the machine are now machined to such a tighter tolerance that it's just not good to interject dirt into the equation. The machine will tolerate some. There's no question about that. But why take the risk, right? Why put a dirty can of DEF into your machine and expect that to function as well as a clean batch of DEF, right? I mean, that's probably the main thing now. There's a lot of things you can do as a walk around. I mean, it's funny to look back over time and, you know, some people are really good about walking around their machine and noticing something that looks out of place or is worn funny or a chain that's loose or a belt that's loose or whatever. And others, all they do is get in the seat and drive. And if you're aware of your machine, if you know what it's supposed to look like and view it every day, that I think that's another mistake people make is, you know, they're just drivers. And, you know, there are operators and there are drivers, and we know who they are, right? And you can go out. It's like driving down the road with your friend. You know, some of them you instantly feel comfortable with, and some of them you think, gosh, I wish I was driving. Same thing, right? So yeah. Take care of your machines and walk around them and know what they're supposed to look like. And recognize something that looks out of place.
Solbrak's advice sounds like common sense, but as anyone knows, common sense is often in short supply. For those who Solbrak defines as drivers today, there's still time to become an operator. After the interview, Solbrak and I wandered through the dealership. In one room, he opened a 5-foot-tall filing cabinet stuffed with notes and background on the book he plans to write. I hope he does, because when you get right down to it, these two podcasts are like the trailer to a coming attraction movie blockbuster and only provide the barest of details of the knowledge and experience he has accumulated over a lifetime. I hope you've enjoyed the second episode of my conversation entitled Dennis Solbrak May Not Bleed Green, But He Lives Green, John Deere Green. Please join me again next time for another episode of Weed All About It.
We're all children of a special treat, a miracle of nature that we just call wheat. A crop that's in the Bible, a crop that's in our bread, a crop that's filled our bellies and held us in its head. Through a history of starvation and times of want and woe, wheat has been our savior.
the problem is when we have enough to eat. But there's only one dilemma, when it's not enough wheat. We feed you.